Okay, here with me today is Dr. Tony Gorshek, who's a professor of software engineering at Blackinger Institute of Technology and also works part-time at Chalmers. And Tony has over 10 years of industrial experience as CTO and senior executive consultant and engineer, also as chief architect and product manager. So he has plenty of experience that he's going to bring to this discussion today. And then in addition, he's built up 5 startups in fields ranging from logistics to internet-based services. So my name is Jane Cleland Wong, and I'm from DePaul University, and we're going to spend some time talking today about the whole idea of technology transfer in the requirements engineering field. So Tony, as you know, one of the questions raised and discussed at the RE conference in Brazil this past summer was whether we as a research community focus sufficient effort on technology transfer, and whether, in fact, we've been successful in seeing research results transferred into practice. But before discussing this in more detail, I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit more about your own background and how you have managed to successfully bridge research and industry.
Sure. So I started my first company after my bachelor's. I barely finished because I started working before. And after my bachelor's, I kind of got into, working in industry. But after a couple of years in industry, I got convinced to finish my master's and then start a PhD by a friend of mine. What interested me about research was the flavor of research we do with BTH, which was basically that we work very closely with industry. So the first half year I was basically sitting in industry only. And that was kind of interesting, and I think that colored how we do things for good and bad. And we kind of were a lot out in industry talking to practitioners and working with practitioners. And by that, we didn't really do a proper assessment. Rather, we got the feel for what the challenges were. And then we also personally invested in how to solve the challenges.
Okay, so would you say that all of your research is primarily driven by your industry research and the kinds of problems that you've seen in industry?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm currently involved in, I don't know, 4 or 5 projects and with different PhD students in different companies, ranging from Ericsson, for example, telecom provider, to Daimler, the car manufacturer. And all of them are with or without PhD students, basically the companies want problems solved. I think the challenge is finding problems and not symptoms, which is kind of difficult to distinguish between. And then finding a problem that's researchable, because we're not consultants, so I mean, you have to be a little careful. But overall, I think there are many challenges out there. So basically, it's a lot of work to do, which is the fun part, I guess.
Yes, I think you raise a really interesting question about the difference between symptoms and problems. So I'm assuming that when you're engaged in industry, they're more likely to tell you about the symptoms, and then how do you kind of get from there to actually identifying researchable problems?
That's a very interesting question, actually. I think that depending on how far you go with the root cause analysis, you can always say that anything is a symptom, right? I mean, the root cause is, I don't know, I mean, the actual cause in the end is maybe the human condition, if you will, right? So I mean, everything that's a problem actually can be seen as a symptom of a deeper underlying problem. But you have to stop somewhere, I guess. I completely agree that industry practitioners, they see their problems, problems this week, this month. They don't really see, okay, maybe in 2 years this is what I would like to be able to do. But as a researcher, it's your job, I think, to try to, so what we do is we do generally assessments, and then we do root cause analysis, and we try to look at the problem from different perspectives. And by looking at it from different perspectives, both in terms of talking to people, but also in terms of studying the problem in its environment, like documentation, like the artifacts themselves, products, mm-hmm. we kind of have the ability to look beyond the symptom description. It's not an easy thing to do. You need to know the domain a little, and you need to invest some time. For example, I mean, I had one company telling me, we have a huge problem because our estimates are very bad. And of course, the natural reaction would be to figure out how to do better estimates, right?
Yeah.
But the fundamental problem wasn't really that. The fundamental problem was that the political system in the company deliberately forced people to do wrong estimates so that they would have a buffer for development.
Yes, and as we know, these are the kinds of things that we face in the requirements engineering domain all the time, these kind of people issues and problems.
Exactly. And so it's not as pure as research when you go out there. It's more of a mess. I mean, but that's a cool thing in my book. It's not as easy to see the forest for all the trees. Finding the root cause is paramount, I think, because otherwise you'll be researching something that might not be that relevant for the company per se.
So I can see, you know, kind of like building on this particular example, you know, you found out that there was this problem, which is kind of like a political problem, but, you know, did you find, was there a research question in that? Because clearly in that example, it sounds like you helped the company solve a problem that they had. But how do you kind of, you know, where's the research in that? And seeing as we're kind of talking at this intersection between research and industry.
I think that's and this example is actually not that bad, luckily. So what happened was, concretely was, so they wanted better estimates, right? And it was generally senior managers who told me this is our problem. And I investigated it, and we figured out that people actually can do better estimates, but they don't for a reason. And that's because there was a confrontative atmosphere between product management and management and the developers and the architects. So instead of looking at better estimates, which was a symptom, we actually went through how you can actually together put the price on activities that are not associated with feature development. Because the buffer that the developers and the architects needed was for refactoring, was for developing the code and the product so that it was maintainable. But it's very hard to put a dollar sign and potential revenues on future maintenance activities. So what we actually looked at is legacy impact and future alternative investment, in terms of being able to put a price tag on, if you do a bad job of implementing something today, what will it cost you in the near future? So, and that was very interesting, because that's value-based software engineering and not really very much explored in the area.
Okay, that's interesting. I'm going to kind of like jump into a question that was raised at the Requirements Engineering Conference last summer when we had a discussion about this. And one of the things that that seemed to kind of have, you know, produce a little bit of tension between the industry researchers and the kind of the industry practitioners and the academic researchers was whether, you know, whether everybody should be kind of addressing the here and now problems. And it sounds like these kind of issues that you're addressing are kind of grounded in industry need, and, you know, you're going to find the research questions and you're going to try and solve the problems, and they're going to kind of make an impact, you know, in the next few months or at least in the short term. Whereas some of the academic requirements engineering researchers were saying, but we want to find bigger kind of longer term problems, and, you know, maybe it will take us 5 years or 10 years to solve them, but we want to be able to kind of look for these, you know, more challenging problems that are not kind of really solvable in the near term future. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on those and how we can kind of balance these two ideas in some way.
Mm-hmm. I'm not a purist. I know some people are, and people are purists in terms of what computer science, what software engineering, what's science and so on. I'm more pragmatic, and I think that researchers should actually, and this might surprise you, but researchers should focus on what they're interested in, what they really like. Because my attitude is this: if you really don't like doing something, you won't do it well. But
yep.
this does not mean that everybody can do very, very long-term, maybe beneficial in the future research only. Because there's a need. I think there is a need of three types, if you will. I mean, if you don't count industry practitioners per se, there's a need for three. I mean, I'm just simplifying, but three types, and that's consultants that actually help them implement stuff. And there is a need for engineering researchers that work very closely with industry, if nothing else, extracting challenges, long-term and short-term challenges, but also solving problems with with industry. And I think there's a need for more long-term researchers that maybe base their research on problems identified in industry, but don't necessarily have to cater to their needs in the short term.
Okay, I think that's actually I like that kind of three-prong perspective.
Yeah, I think that, but the problem we get is that if you and this is my personal opinion, wrong or right, is that it's more status, it's looked well upon. The thing that is looked what's the word in English?
Kind of esteemed, highly esteemed, like that.
Thank you. What's regarded with higher esteem is the third part, which is long term. Excuse my French, sitting in your office doing research, right, and tackling the big problems, quotation mark end quotation, right, and I think that's kind of a unnecessary and quite unintelligent way of looking at things, because there's nothing to say that solving short-term problems, say 1 or 2 year problems, is less challenging than trying to solve something that might have an impact in 10 years. Actually, the opposite, because when you try to solve really large problems, you tend to simplify a lot, and you tend to not involve messy business of humans and politics and everything else that influences.
And scalability.
While if you're trying, exactly. So I'm not saying one is better than the other or one is purer than the other. What I'm saying is you need at least one third of resources in each part.
Yes, I think it's an interesting perspective, and I actually kind of, you know, really believe in it. I know in my own research, which is in software traceability, when we started our project about 10 years ago, we naively thought that it would be a short-term project, and now 10 years later, we've realized it's, something that has many long-term challenges. But along the way, we've run pilot studies and things like that to get feedback from industry, and that's kind of helped us, you know, keep the vision and understanding of what the real problems are and the scalability issues and the usability issues in practice. So I kind of see that as a way to meld these three areas together too.
I don't think you should be a purist. I mean, it's not like, okay, I'm the third type. That's not really what I mean. I mean, I think companies need low-hanging fruit solutions that are short-term, say half a year to a year. So the same researcher should optimally be working on some long-term issues that kind of arise and some short-term issues in parallel. And it's great, as you say, if you can deliver parts, right? So, for example, in the research projects we run, which is the projects are between 3 and 5 years, and they're financed by industry directly, many of them. And basically what that means, of course, is that the long-term perspective is maybe 5 years for certain aspects. Some aspects might take 2 generations of projects for 10 years, and no company will be okay with paying you a lot of money and waiting 5 years for results.
Yeah.
They want something intermediate, I mean, something in between, and what you generally deliver is Maybe you deliver a process assessment of the report, basically detailing the challenges you found and possibilities for solving some of the issues immediately with research that's already out there. This is not my job as a researcher, but it's my job as a salesman because I want them involved, right?
So
it's an ongoing relationship. It's not something you go out and collect some data and then return to your office and sit there for 2 years. You have to deliver something continuously. And I think that's the major challenge with most researchers is that they don't really have this relationship with the client, with the research partner, the industry partner, because it's a lot of work.
So let's talk about that for a minute, because my understanding from previous conversations with you and others is that Sweden has a very kind of close collaboration between academia and industry, and I know, for example, here in the States, I have to work long and hard to build my industry contacts and to kind of build the level of trust that they'll share data and talk about their problems. And I thought maybe we could kind of explore, you know, what if you are an industry and you have problems and you would like to collaborate with some researchers? What do you think would be the first steps to kind of take to go in that direction, or do you have any advice for them?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I mean, I think we are collaboration possibilities in Sweden with industry is bad, but I've realized it's worse in other places. I'm never
relative.
Satisfied. I mean, yeah, exactly. And I think that, so I think you have to be credible in the people's eyes in industry. And in order for you to do that, it's not bad if you're actually a little of a salesman. It's not a bad thing. But optimally, you have to be honest. And that's the cool thing about being a researcher. The reason why I'm a researcher and not a consultant is pure, simple, this. And that's I can tell industry partners the truth without playing the political game, which I had to play if I was a consultant or hired at the company. And I think this resonates very well with people who are tired of hearing consultants preaching to them in order to sell hours, or their own employees kind of being very threading very carefully not to make enemies. And I think that this is a fresh thing for companies. I actually think they welcome this. But I think that you need to package it so that they understand you're not a consultant. Rather, you are a researcher, so what you do will not always be 100% applicable for their case. But since their cost is and the risk is very low, if they get 50% benefit, it's a great thing. And then, of course, you should have a reasonable time plan after an assessment, and they kind of identify the challenges. You have a time plan of what to deliver, which can, of course, change. So it's more of a... you're concrete. It's not fluffy. You have to be fairly concrete when working with industry. They have to see the payback, the benefit. They invest maybe, say, a couple of thousand hours in a year in collaborating with you. They have to see, well, that's rather high cost. What will we get? And so I think you have to have a philosophy of payback for the company, both short and long term, in order for you to be able to sell it to the company. They should invest.
Okay. I think that definitely. I know in my experience of my tech transfer projects, it's like, you know, it's been very important to find a champion in the company that really believes in the project, and secondly, as you say, to really make sure we deliver what we promise incrementally. So at the end of every year, at least, there's something very concrete that they can kind of hold in their hands and see what we've done and see that it gives them benefits.
Champion is extremely important. That you and maybe a couple of them, because you know, as you know, I mean, people tend to quit or get promoted.
Yes. Or retire.
So, exactly.
Yes. I just also wondered, have you seen, I don't know if you know how much you can share about this, but if, you know, you've done a lot of these kind of industry-driven research projects, and I wondered if you have any kind of You know, anything you can tell us about what kind of thing or issues cause them to fail? You know, have you? I'm sure there's.
Yeah.
You know, they don't always work. Is it just the opposite of the positive things we've said, or are there any kind of specific kind of danger signs that this isn't a good project for us to work on together, or expectations are not kind of well communicated, or those kinds of things?
There are many, many things that make projects fail, and probably it's much easier, to be honest, to fail than not. I would say that in my experience, there are a couple of things that are central. Getting your foot in is one thing. That's what we've been discussing thus far, you know, by convincing people and giving them payback. That's getting your foot in. Once you have your foot in, a whole new range of problems arise. And one of the biggest challenges I've had is not made here. As an external party, you have some benefits, right? You're independent. You don't have an agenda, that kind of thing. But if you do not find allies in the company that can actually take results and package them and say, this is our results, then you're kind of just a guy suggesting something, and who are you to suggest that because they are successful? I mean, per definition, the companies we work with are very successful. Otherwise, they don't have money to do the research.
Yeah.
So that's a challenge. I mean, I know it's fluffy, but the politics of an external party wanting you to change, and if you don't get internal support for this change, then I think the change is very hard. And it doesn't matter if it's a good solution, if nobody uses it, it's meaningless. So that's one challenge. Another challenge, I think, is time. It takes time and effort. It takes huge amounts of time and effort to get. So let's say they have a problem, I invented a solution, which say it's a model of sorts, and they should utilize this model, which is a process framework, say, for example, to change their behavior and develop software in a different way. I mean, from me figuring out what it is, inventing it with them, testing it very statically and, you know, and through experimentation and so on, and then trying to implement it for a pilot project in their company, that's 3 to 4 years.
Yeah.
And very few researchers want to invest this time and efforts, in my opinion at least. Very few researchers want to do that work. And it's because you could do other stuff, right? You can tackle larger problems. You could.
Yes.
Because, you know when you publish the first time, I mean, the new idea, that's maybe after a year, year and a half. But to get a proper technology transfer cycle, you know, where they adapt it and actually use it, and then you can measure the results, that's another 2 or 3 years. Which means our payback as researchers in terms of publications is met very quickly. But if we leave it at that after a year, year and a half, it's completely meaningless for industry. They can't use it. Because it's not adapted specifically for their case, haven't trained the people, you don't have the proper sales in terms of establishing that they should test it and do the change, you don't have the commitment. And so the cycle is maybe 3-4 years, but we as researchers get payback in terms of publication after a year, year and a half.
But presumably you take the time to kind of, you know, to carry this through, you can publish different kinds of papers that are more kind of perhaps experience reports or...
You can absolutely, but I would say that, so example of my PhD project, which was the requirements abstraction model, the first paper was out a year after the project started, and that's the most cited paper. Then I have three other papers that basically report on the results from the actual implementation, full scale. And they're barely cited, and basically I have 2 papers after 1 year and 2 papers after additional 3 years.
Yeah.
So my point is, bang for the buck, I should basically just go out, find issues, solve them, not test them more than, you know, very, very abstractly or not with industry in reality, and then carry on to the next problem, because that's the way I would be rewarded as an academic in terms of number of publications, in terms of citations. And that's kind of counterproductive to technology transfer.
The reward system is not in place. So let me ask you this question.
If you think back to the
projects that you have engaged in and you have followed them through beyond that first year and a half, so you've invested in, you know, the time to kind of actually do the technology transfer, how many of them stick? So I've seen cases of technology transfer which have been very, very effective in industry as long as the research champion is on site and can keep guiding people through the process. But as soon as the champion or the researcher leaves, then the process is no longer used. So, you know, what is the payback in the end for that extra, you know, investment? Are the projects retained? Are the methods and processes used beyond the time that you are engaged?
So I've done, because I do more than one project in parallel, so I've done about, proper transfer of five iterations, or five fundamentally different solutions, not sub-solutions, but five fundamentally different things, five or six, depending on your count. And I would say that about, I think four have stuck properly. But, so I think that the payback there, I think two things are key. One is I don't do action research. I'm very careful when the technology or the model, whatever I develop, is ready for transfer. I make sure to train champions on site which are not researchers. And then I step back and observe them use the technology as they see fit. Because if I get involved, you know, I do the modeling or I do the requirements or I do whatever, it will be great for them because they basically get the full-time researcher doing work for them and they don't have to do it. And of course, it's beneficial for them. But when I go home, they don't have that resource, right? So you have to let them make the mistakes. You have to let them misuse your ideas. I mean, half of the things we invented together and we tried to transfer is used, but it's not used as I intended from the beginning. Not necessarily worse, but differently, right? And maybe some things are lost, maybe some things are added, but it's kind of a self-controlling system that if they think something is not necessary, even if I do, I think it's okay because I'm not the one actually doing the work or paying the bill. As long as I can improve something and they see the benefit of it, I'm kind of happy with that. And I would say the investment, so why do I do it? Because if I'm optimizing my academic career, right, I shouldn't. I do it because I like actually making a difference.
Yeah.
Not to researchers, per se. It's always nice when another researcher thinks what you're doing is relevant and nice. That's perfectly good. But I prefer industry and not being happy with what I do, but using what I do. I think that's my reward. It's very personal.
Kind of building, I understand that, and I think you've been a great exemplar in the requirements engineering community for all of, you know, your effort on technology transfer and the leadership role you've taken in kind of talking about this. And, you know, just as a kind of follow-on question for that, so in the end, who do you actually think is responsible for technology transfer?
I think the responsibility lies, and of course I'm going to be very Swedish about this, I think the responsibility lies in both parties. One thing I noticed, and one thing that's kind of good in Sweden, is when you, first of all, there's very little hierarchy in companies, right? And there's very little, I'm the boss, so you listen to me, which is a really good thing, and that kind of enables you to have a fairly open relationship with the companies, but it requires maturity. Most companies I start working with for the first time, they require 3 or 4 years together with us to actually mature enough and build trust.
And then I think that the responsibility is in both parties. They need to actually try to look beyond their current problems and understand that what you do is maybe not applicable immediately, but maybe in a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
But you as a researcher need to understand their position. They take a risk, right? Not only do they invest time and effort into doing something in a new way, they also invest the time because they do not do product development at the same time, right? So they actually not only invest in your idea, they lose momentum in their own. So it's actually double investment for them. And the more comprehensive the change or improvement is, the larger the risk. Which means I think that the researcher has an obligation to stepwise validate the solution. You know, you start maybe with an experiment, then with a small workshop, then with a larger thing, then with a pilot, you know, like a cycle.
Yeah.
I think you need to do this very structured and very and report every step and change and improve the methodology every step so that the company feels that risk is minimized. But their responsibility is to, if you try to do this, they have to listen and they have to really want to improve. So I think it's a dual thing, and it's a, like everything else in life, it's building a relationship that works. Sometimes it doesn't. I have a perfect example of this of a company where we transferred something which was great. They used it for 2 years, and there it was radical in terms of improving how they do product development. Then I come, then they call me a year after we start stopped collaborating and say it's gone to hell. Please come and help us. I go back to the company as a consultant. This time, because they wanted fast help, and this was the only way I could do it, so I go back, and I figure out that they've basically thrown away everything we did. And I ask the senior manager there, well, I mean, what happened? Well, the champion, he quit, and then, of course, our projects were never late, so we didn't do this. Well, I know, they weren't late because you did it.
Yeah.
So the thing we implemented was actually the thing that caused very few mop-ups in the end. They did testing very early, and things were very successful. They could actually estimate projects very well, both in terms of risk and time and calendar time. But then, since their projects were so good, they basically just cut some costs, right? And by doing that, they were reverting to the status before the research project.
Yeah.
So basically, we just,
like
I just told them...
medicine taking.
Exactly. So it was really funny when I went there because it was so black and white. Reality selling black and white, right? But this was basically, they did implementation proposals with handshaking. Everything worked. They stopped doing it. Everything fell apart.
Yeah.
And then I basically told them, well, I built them 1 hour, actually. Symbolically, I built them 1 hour and told them what to do. And they did it, and it worked again. So, you know, it's not a foregone conclusion that even if something really works, that people will use it long term anyway, because people are weird and
wonderful, I think that kind of,
and smart.
Yeah.
But
I think that highlights the kind of the complexity of the kind of, you know, requirements engineering area where you have technical problems and you have political problems and you have people challenges, and they all have to kind of fit together. But
and that's a really cool thing about the area. That's my favorite thing about requirements engineering. Actually, I could easily see myself doing contributions in other areas, and I try to do so. I mean, I do a little testing, I do a little process assessment and improvements and stuff. But what I really like about requirements engineering is that it's extremely human dependent, and that is source of the headache, but it's also a source of inspiration.
Yes, I think that's the reason I really enjoy working in this area too. But you've given us a lot of really interesting insights now into this whole area of technology transfer, and I think we'll kind of bring this interview towards a closing here. But I wondered if in closing you have, you know, anything that you you know, still feel that you'd like to kind of tell us that I haven't asked you about, or any kind of closing remarks?
I think that One thing that's kind of important is, well, two things. One, a problem can be very complex, but a solution has to be very simple. And that's kind of counterintuitive because research results that are complex and advanced always seem to be sexier in some way. I think this is actually, the underlying problem can be very complex, but the solution has to be so simple that it's almost too simple to be research. At the first glance, because I think that one has to factor in two things, the actual solution to the problem and the possibility or the enabler of making this solution useful and usable and scalable in reality. And the combination of this is the complex thing. So a very simple solution, let's say inspections, which is a very simple thing, right?
Yeah.
But actually getting people to use inspections or reviews in combination with the technology of inspection is not that easy. So I think you need to look at both of them as a joint thing in terms of complexity. So a solution can be very simple but still very, very relevant in terms of research results. It doesn't have to be complex. I don't know if I'm making any sense, but that's kind
no,
of
No, I think
my...
you absolutely are making sense, and I agree with you. I know in my own research sometimes we come up with rather complex solutions and we put a lot of time into them, and then we kind of step back and we take a look and we say which bits really worked and which bits do we
yeah.
think we want to carry forward into the next phase of the research. So we kind of, we may publish it all because we invested a lot of time in it, but in the end we want to know which are the keepers and which are the bits we want to take on, and I think that goes for the heart of this kind of simplicity.
Absolutely,
issue.
And don't misunderstand me. I think negative results are very, very important, and they're often dismissed by researchers. I don't really understand why, though. Because negative results, I mean, for example, if I develop 5 models for a solution and only one is relevant because that's the only one that's useful for industry, the other 4 are also important because if nothing else, it tells you what avenues you investigated and what people can avoid in the future. So negative
yeah.
results are extremely important. What I have a little problem with is some researchers publishing a huge amount of things never tested, which can maybe then be a negative result and then spamming the community with 50 of those papers. But we all see this, and yeah, that's reality.
And I mean,
you want to publish what you did.
Yes, and I think also, you know, kind of going back to your discussion about kind of the initial 1.5 years is when you're trying out a new idea. And, you know, you don't necessarily want to take all of those ideas on into industry because you may realize that, hey, it was good enough to publish a paper. You know,
yeah.
we discussed its pros and cons, but we don't think, based on our 1.5 years of working with this, that this is going to be what we want to invest our kind of technology transfer in because we see other areas that are more promising. So I feel that's also
yeah.
part of the kind of the research process, and the good things will kind of bubble
yeah.
up and kind of go farther, and then the, you know, the things that we thought might be good ideas but in the end didn't work as well as we wanted them to, then we can kind of abandon them. And I think that's all part of the research process too, perhaps.
I agree completely, and I mean sometimes you want to present a couple of good ideas and you do it through papers because then somebody else can take the torch and run with it if they're interested in the specific area and they don't have
yeah.
to start from scratch. So absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just that when you go the entire cycle, you know, when you go the 3-4 years and the actual thing that you end up with that's possible to transfer and people actually use is often fairly simple. And
yeah.
the gut reaction from researchers is, oh, but this is too simple to be relevant from a research perspective. But not if you weigh in the fact that it's actually transferred and actually used in reality and has changed how people behave and develop software. Then there is an added value in addition to the actual solution, if you get what I mean. And this,
yeah.
I think, needs to be recognized. Otherwise, there's no point and no payoff for the researchers trying to do the cycle.
Okay. And yeah, I think that's like some great insights into kind of technology transfer from both the industry side and from the researcher side. And I think you've given us a lot of things to think about. And hopefully this will just be the kind of beginning or the middle part of the conversation.
I hope so. And thank you very much for having me. I mean, I'm happy to share my experiences of failing. I've always learned more from failure than success anyway.
Okay, well,
thank you very much.
Thank you very much.